Welcome to Saints and Sinners Unplugged with your hosts, New York Times bestselling authors, Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. In this episode, we've got a great story to tell with two experts on the case itself. And I'm going to paint the picture a little bit before I bring in our two guests. In the early morning hours of March 18th, 1990, two thieves posing as Boston cops gained entry to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, an Italian-style palazzo in the Fenway area of Boston. They tied up the security guards and stole 13 works of art worth an estimated $500 million. Now, the artworks by Vermeer, Rembrandt, and others, they've never been recovered. Now, joining us today on this podcast, we've got Lance Greensterner and Tim Polleri. Both are the hosts of Empty Frames, a great podcast dedicated to finally solving the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist and telling some amazing stories along the way. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Casey and Dave. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's always fun to revisit the Gardner heist with a couple of people who know a lot about it as well and get those opinions and just sort of suss out everything. It's fun.
Great to have you guys on, and we love your work, and we were excited when we were able to connect with you guys to bring you on the show. And the Gardner Museum, as you said, is something Casey and I have followed, you know, for many years as journalists and now as podcasters and authors and all that. Casey is much more the expert in the case than I am. But I guess if you don't mind, I'd just like to kick off with, what is it about this case that you think continues to fascinate?
It's a great question. And the one thing that comes to my mind all the time is that people love true crime. They love solving a mystery. They love untangling a knot. And just doing all of the other shows that we do, we find that people always want to figure out what happened in a certain circumstance. And for the most part, the Gardner heist is, it has victims involved, but not to the level of like an unsolved murder or a disappearance of a young woman or something like that. Like, it feels like you're entering into the script of something. It feels like you're now a character in there and you're meeting all of these new characters along for the ride as you're going into it. You're meeting gangsters, you're meeting art experts. And I don't want to say it feels like a good time, but for a true crime lover, it's a good time. And if you get to figure out what happened, you're like a local hero.
One of the great things I love about the podcast, and you just mentioned it, are all the characters that you bring in. And they all have different perspectives on the case. And you learn a little bit more each time that you bring on people like Charlie Hill, for example, who's the art investigator that helped recover, the infamous or famous painting, The Scream, which was stolen in Oslo in 1984. You've brought on people like Turbo Paul Henry, you know, a roguish character, if you will, and then other art detectives like Arthur Brand. You know, what do they bring to the show?
Some credibility, I guess, in the art world. I also think it's amazing, and this speaks to the first question as well, but how you can have a debate on this topic and you can make strong points on basically any side you want. You can say this was a job done by professionals, and you can give reasons why. I mean, they didn't get caught. They impersonated police. And then you could say this is a job that was done by amateurs and they lucked into certain things, you know, and you can make really strong points and have a great conversation on both of those. And I think that's what our guests bring. They bring a take, you know, they have a strong take.
I gave an overview at the top of the show here, but drill down a little bit, talk a little bit about the artwork that was taken in 1990.
Sure. I mean, you have some very famous pieces of art. Even before the theft, you have the concert by Vermeer. That was, the most, I think that's the one that's valued at the highest level at this point. And then Rembrandt's only seascape, which is the Storm on the Sea of Galilee. That's the giant one where you see in all of the pictures when you Google Gardner Museum heist, you see the empty frame of that. And that was his only seascape. And he actually painted himself in there looking at you, which is such a loss for the art community to not be able to experience that firsthand, to be in that beautiful museum and looking at that painting. Now you just look at the empty frames. And to dig a little deeper into the empty frames themselves, we had a guest on, Liz Lenz, who actually got choked up when she was talking about how they were cut with a razor blade or whatever, a knife. They were cut out. And I didn't understand the gravity of these, like the importance of these paintings, until she started getting choked up about it and the serious loss. Like, what kind of person it takes to sink a razor blade into like Rembrandt's only seascape. Like you're just not, you're it's an absolute like slap in the face to history.
Go back to how the robbers gained access to the museum that night. And again, you just touched on something that's interesting. You know, were these pros or were these amateurs, and how did they get in, and what did they do in the 81 minutes that they were inside the museum? And again, 81 minutes, guys, that means that they really took their time here.
Yeah. I mean, that's almost as long as a Hollywood comedy. To be walking around in that museum. And, you know, you can see some of the motion sensors, see their steps from the motion sensors. And that's interesting to see. But yeah, I mean, this is definitely two thieves who were not concerned about getting, like, seemingly getting the theft broken up before they were ready to leave.
Now, does that speak to an inside job? You know, the role that the security guards played or didn't play in this has always been debated over the past 30 years. Talk a little bit about them.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point and definitely something that comes up a lot on the podcast or anytime you talk about this case. Was it an inside job? Well, it sure looks like it because there are certain factors that the guards opened the door. They opened the doors, two doors for them. And there was also the opening of a side door before the thieves were let in, which is something that didn't usually happen, apparently. And so that kind of speaks to the possibility of one of the guards having some inside knowledge. But then you also look like, what did these guards get, or what did this guard get other than some duct tape over his face that night? And right. And he's kind of like a stoner type character, at least back then. And he like found a bag of weed on the ground on the street at one time. And he was like, gee, did they leave it for me? Like, so he's either so honest and just like, I don't know, like completely almost uncaring about the situation, or, you know, maybe he was strong armed into it or something like that. Not exactly sure.
If he was strong-armed into it, it's a secret he's kept for 30 years, you know, whether he's been interviewed by the FBI or others. You know, he was, from what I remember, it was a student at the Berklee College of Music, or I know he was a musician of some kind. And it doesn't look like he's profited at all over the past 30 years, given, you know, the stakes that were, you know, in play that night.
Yeah, and he rarely does interviews unless they're very, very vetted. He's never responded to any requests that we had for an interview, which sort of forced us to go in a direction that I think was more beneficial to the show, which was have people on that you don't typically hear about. But getting back to that guard, he was known to have parties there. And maybe I'm not saying like throw down parties and they're like breaking stuff, but he was known to invite people over. They probably smoked some weed and they would walk the, you know, walk the corridors, walk the galleries. And so it wasn't uncommon for him to be loose with the regulations. And I don't think I'm speaking out of turn. I think that's pretty well known that he was pretty loose with the rules and regulations there. And I think on top of him being tied up, duct taped, put in the boiler room, the fact that he opens the door and no, like, there was no emergency call made. And I think a lot of people get hung up on that. Sure, he was looking at police, but maybe it's in the training. He just wasn't trained properly, because I think a lot of people will say, well, you're not even sure if they are police. I mean, this is at night. They're saying they're police. They're wearing uniforms. Why wouldn't you call the emergency or alert emergency anyway? It's like as a job in your job description, why wouldn't you do that? So I think that's something that, at least for me and some listeners, stand out, is that you had a real clear window to actually call the police. And there's some discrepancy, right, whether or not these were police or dressed as police officers or dressed as security guards. I can't really remember, but I've heard both too.
And I think, you know, you look at the security guards, the Gardner guys, you know, they're making what, $6 an hour? You know, I mean, the security was incredibly lax at the time. I'm sure their training was nil. So the ability to get in and kind of bum rush, if you will, these security guys, tie them up in the basement. I've been in the basement in the exact area where they were tied up, and then take 81 minutes to go through and pick and choose really kind of what they wanted, which to me is one of the fascinating parts of this whole story. You know, there's incredible pieces of art at the Gardner Museum that were left untouched, and some, you know, minor pieces that were taken along with the Vermeer, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that also is part of the reason why people are fascinated about this, because there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to what they took. It's not like they took all Vermeer or all Degas or all Rembrandt. They took a little bit from here and there, and it wasn't even like they took a certain size. So you can't even determine what kind of car they had or vehicle they had as a getaway vehicle, because they took the gigantic Storm on the Sea of Galilee, but then they also took Tim's favorite, the Che Tortoni.
You love Che Tortoni.
Gotta love that big hat, you know?
Big hat. He looks so relaxed.
Yeah. We wonder what he's up to today.
Where are you, Che?
Well, you know, Dave and I were, I was, I think, a junior, and I think Dave was maybe a sophomore at BC. I was at BU, but we remember the story like it was yesterday. And it did happen on, St. Patrick's Night in 1990, where I'm sure we were down at Faneuil Hall or Quincy Market ripping it up till about 2 o'clock in the morning ourselves. And we, you know, wake up and grab our first cup of coffee of the day and grab a Boston Herald and see the big headlines. So, you know, Dave, talk a little bit about your experience with the Gardner Museum heist, when it happened and over the years.
Yeah. So I actually was going to ask you guys something. Casey and I, you know, you mentioned at the top how, you know, your podcast, you bring in all these different characters and gangsters and that sort of stuff. Casey and I wrote a book called Hunting Whitey. There's been a lot of speculation, information, misinformation over the years about Whitey Bulger's potential involvement in the Gardner heist. What have you guys learned about his involvement or lack thereof?
Well, probably nothing that you guys haven't learned or was written about in your book, in your fantastic book, which I devoured and loved, by the way. And I mean, it's an interesting story with Whitey Bulger. I mean, we know he sort of ran Boston and the organized crime aspect of Boston back then. So a lot of people say, well, if a major crime like that, the Gardner heist happened, Whitey would have had to have known about it, or he would have threatened people to find out about it. So I think there's a possibility he knew more about it, but it doesn't seem like he ever had the artwork.
Yeah. You know, we interviewed one of Whitey Bulger's friends behind bars for the book, and Bulger would talk about the Gardner Museum at length while he's sitting in the prison yard in Arizona. And, you know, he said that he had nothing to do with it, you know, that he wished that he had, because it would have given him some currency to use in case he was ever prosecuted. And earlier than that, I interviewed Kevin Weeks, who was Bulger's surrogate son. And he said, of course, we knew about the heist after it happened, and they dragged in every two-bit criminal in the Boston area, shook them down to try to find out information as to where these paintings were, but could never get any actual, you know, evidence to act upon.
Yeah, it's a great point that he said he wished that he was a part of it, because he would have had that currency. And I think that's the feather in the cap for me, or whatever you say. Like, that's the convincing factor for me, is that I feel like if he knew, he would have used something to help. Was it his common law wife that was also arrested?
His girlfriend for many years, Catherine Gray.
Yeah. Like, he would have used that at least to bargain some sort of reduced sentence for her. I think.
For sure. That, you know, it would have, you know, solved the last great, you know, Boston crime mystery, which is really what this is, isn't it? Yeah. And I think that, you know, obviously it's got worldwide attention from the Netflix series, This Is a Robbery. I don't know how you guys feel about that show, but it was a kind of a surface level introduction, if you will, to the story itself, where you guys drill down a lot deeper in your episodes, which is why I find it so fascinating.
Yeah, I think we approached it the way most people approach it, where you have the usual suspects. And I don't mean like specifically individuals, but you have the usual theories, you have the usual persons of interest, the gangsters. And because there were other projects going on simultaneously, like concurrently with our launch of Empty Frames, we were limited to other people because of these other projects that were better funded and had better press behind them. And I think that was quickly identified by Tim and I and our partner, Mr. K, as something that could be really unique in telling the story of the heist, is that no one's ever interviewed. She wasn't a guard, Marge Gallis. She was a desk guard, security. But she had some amazing stories to tell about events that happened, just prior to the heist, where they were doing construction and the foreman locked himself in the security office and wouldn't come out. And she had to get her manager to come and get him out. And he couldn't tell anybody what he was doing in there. It's just really cool insight into the museum that you don't get when you go down those usual avenues. And even some background on Isabella Stewart Gardner herself, which I think if you're looking into the heist, please look into her too. She was a force. She was amazing.
Well, talk a little bit more about her.
Well, she walked a lion down Tremont Street. and apparently that's true. I mean, there's a bunch of really sort of extreme examples of her behavior because she was sort of like a socialite in Boston, which is, you know, kind of a buttoned up community, especially when you get to like the wealthy circles. So I think she stood out because of that. She wore her hair in various interesting ways. But yeah, that one about the lion is the one that really sticks with me because there's actually a Boston Globe blurb from it. She actually did walk a lion down Tremont Street.
I enjoy the story of her throwing parties like donut parties and playing hide and seek in the museum with John Singer Sargent. Her and him had an incredible relationship and they would play hide and seek. And I'm giving air quotes here. I'm pretty sure there might have been a little bit more to their hide and seek game. Just Liz Lenz, again, who was on our show, had said that if she was alive today, she'd be like a Kardashian, where she knows she's got the influence and she knows she's making a difference, but she's presenting herself in an air of like, I don't give an F. Like, I'm going to wear my Boston Red Sox cap to the opera and people are going to gasp when they see a woman of wearing this Red Sox paraphernalia.
She had a little bit of degaff in her. She had a tragedy. She lost her child at a very young age. And then she started accumulating all this art, which is really pretty, I mean, absolutely amazing. The art collection is incredible and the building.
Now, again, you know, that was her personal home. And when she passed, I mean, the name of your podcast is Empty Frames. Why are the frames still on the walls without those paintings in them?
Well, it was in her will, in Miss Gardner's will, apparently, that the artwork, you know, after her passing, the artwork in the museum cannot be moved. And I think if it was ever moved, it would have to be all donated to Harvard University, I believe, which is, you know, pretty probably some weird gray areas there because there is a board now that decides things. And, you know, they rent stuff out and bring it. I don't know. So they might play a little fast and loose with that. But the frames are hanging on the walls empty, the ones that were, you know, cut out of the frame. So they say that, you know, they can't remove the frames because of the will, or else the entire collection would have to be donated to Harvard. Now, would they want to move the frames? I would think not. I mean, the museum serves as an incredible museum with amazing art, but also a crime scene. And that's what makes visiting it so incredible.
No, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's a beautiful place, but you know, that extra aura of the fact that you're standing in the middle of one of the, you know, great art heists in history, and it almost looks like it did the night of the robbery itself, it makes it, you know, equally interesting for true crime buffs as well. You know, the Gardner robbery was in the news recently upon the death of Robert Gentile. Talk a little bit about him and his possible connection to the robbery.
He was a guy who was involved in organized crime in Connecticut. His house was searched in a major way years ago. They found some, well, I guess what the FBI thought were like remnants of maybe the artwork was there at one point. I believe there was like a sort of a secret shed with a floor in the backyard that was, you know, not a big area, but could have housed some paintings, some stolen paintings. And they also found like a price list in his basement, which was the artwork laid out, the 13 stolen pieces of artwork and like the price that they would get on the black market, I guess. But they never found any artwork there. And then he passed away recently, Robert Gentile, and he was in prison for a while too. I mean, this is another one of those things where like, if he actually had the paintings, he probably would have used it, played that card at some point. So maybe he knew about it at one point, but I don't think he did when he passed away.
And there's also the report from the widow of another mobster that ran in the same circles as Gentile, that he had given him two of the paintings and had also talked about the rest of the stolen work while in prison. So this woman, this widow, had given this report that I think it was in Maine where they had met, and they had passed off two of the paintings. And I'm not even sure if she could specify which paintings they were. And again, like the same thing with Whitey, you know, this would have benefited him in his later years. He was getting sick. I think he lived to be like 85, but those last years, I think, took a toll on him. And I think just for his family's sake, and any interview that we've read or seen of him, he seems like he seems like a very humble and proud man. And I feel like if this could have been a redeeming thing for him, at the very least, if he knew the whereabouts. But he was also a career criminal. Like,
it's fascinating listening to you guys, all your knowledge about Isabella Stewart Gardner, stuff I did not know. And, you know, that's the reason Casey and I launched our podcast, is really to tell these like real true crime stories. But a lot of them have that Boston flavor. And I think, you know, back to what the first question I asked you at the beginning was, you know, this is such a quintessential Boston story, but it does have the global element. It's got the mystery. But that time in the early 90s in Boston was such a unique time. It was really the reign of the Bulger Gang, which is why Whitey's name is always brought up, as you mentioned. You know, it seems to defy logic that he would have not known this happened. But, you know, I think that, you know, you guys are really on to something with bringing in all these folks that have some new insight. So who's coming up on the show that we might hear from in upcoming episodes?
The show was airing on Stitcher Premium exclusively for a while. So contractually, we had to wait for our episodes to go public. So we do have one more that's about to go public. It is an interview with Dennis House of a news station in Connecticut, who interviewed Robert Gentile. His last interview was with a reporter, a really great guy named Dennis House. And we have a fun conversation about it. And it was recorded before Mr. Gentile passed away. And we do plan on doing more episodes, because this is a story that is not over.
I really liked the episode where you interviewed Arthur Brand. Talk a little bit about Arthur. I've written about Arthur and interviewed him for my column with the Boston Herald. He's got a track record of recovering major pieces of stolen art across the world, but he's been kind of on the outside looking in on this case, and he doesn't feel like he's either had the cooperation of the FBI or the cooperation of Anthony Amore, the security advisor or supervisor at the Gardner Museum. Talk a little bit about Arthur.
Arthur's great. I mean, we had him on and we had a great conversation, and he's got so much information. He's got so much experience in art recovery. And what comes with him is a passion that also elicits a reaction from some of our other guests. And if they don't agree, then it does become a thing. And then it's not like we're being asked to take sides, but we get the communication. Can you believe this person's doing this? This person's doing this. And we're almost put in the middle of it. And I'm not complaining about that at all. It's just a recognizing of, wow, this so much passion coming from Arthur Brand is bringing out this emotion in Turbo, or bringing out this emotion in Anthony Amore, or his counter.
Muddy River fact checker.
Yes, the Muddy River fact checker, the anonymous guy that we had on, who's got so much information on this. It's ridiculous. But it was really like a community building that I don't want to say he directly brought, but he was sort of like the pin in all of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, if you want to just see how they go back and forth against each other, just check out their Twitter handles. And you constantly see, you know, how they snipe at each other, you know, given their different theories on the case. You know, Arthur Brand has always been of the thought, as has Turbo, that, you know, the reward itself needs to be broken up to individual art pieces, and that nobody has the collection as a whole anymore. And there's also a concern about, you know, whether the thieves or anybody who has the art today would have the kind of immunity needed to, if they ever brought forth these art pieces. So I think you have a lot of, I would say, snobbery in this case as well. You look at, you know, Anthony Amore is a guy that's been leading the charge within the museum for what, 16 years? And he's, you know, really failed in his job, quite frankly. I mean, I feel very strongly about it. Amore was a guy that, you know, got his job, and I think he probably overstated his experience a little bit. He used to tell everybody that he was the lead investigator, or one of the lead investigators, in the infamous Richard Reed shoe bomber case. Well, I interviewed Charlie Gianturco, the head FBI agent who actually arrested Richard Reed, and he'd never heard Amore's name before. And this was about a year ago. So, you know, I think Amore is a guy that, you know, he passes himself off as this Agatha Christie-like Hercule Poirot, but he's really, in my opinion, an Inspector Clouseau a bit. And, you know, I feel strongly about this, but I just see him online on Twitter all the time. You know, he spends more time on social media than I think he does actually investigating this case, or whether the FBI even allows him to investigate this case.
It's a great point. And I think all of us being from this area, there's not a lot of cities where you can have something like this happen and you can use a pretty relevant sports comparison. Could you imagine if Bill Belichick was hired as the Patriots head coach and lost every single season for 16 years? Like that wouldn't even be a thing. You'd be gone. And I think there's not a lot of places in the country that can make that comparison. Dude, you were hired to do that. Is specifically your job. Security. It's the biggest heist in probably the world. Like, how do you have nothing?
Well, do you think the FBI takes him seriously or just kind of keeps him at arm's length because he is the, you know, official face of the, you know, Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum? And I'll say that the only person that seems to have profited from the heist is Anthony Amore himself. He's written several books. He's even, you know, written coloring books based on art heists. He ran for Secretary of State in Massachusetts a couple of years ago and failed. So to me, he's kind of a comic book character himself.
I think he put himself in the right position and got in front of the right people and said the right things before they could realize what the actual agenda was. And I don't even know if he knew what his agenda was. I think he saw the potential, but sort of plotted it out. Oh, I could write a book. I could now that went well. I'll write another book. I'll run for some form of public official. And I think he probably plotted it out along the way. I don't want to keep going and get myself in trouble, but he did really limit. And I'm not, maybe people will listen and say, well, we're just jealous because we, you know, no, you know, we're not in his shoes or we didn't profit the way he did. And it's not the case at all. I really, really, really get irritated thinking about the failure on his part and the lack of accepting that failure and taking responsibility for it because the paintings aren't there. Those are paintings that should be found. And it's got nothing to do with like how much he's profited. It's got to do with you haven't restored the historical, you haven't done your job. You haven't restored it. You haven't done what you were hired to do. Like, could you imagine what Isabella Stewart Gardner herself would say to him if she was around to say, like, her property's gone and you were in place for 16 years and you did nothing except write some books.
Yeah, I think the coloring books would probably get on her nerves a little bit, to be honest. But I think it's a tough mystery, you know, but yeah, there should be some progress for sure.
Now, if you were, you know, to venture to guess, and I'm sure you guys rack your brains on this every day, where would you say the likely whereabouts of some of the lost art treasures are today? Are they in the U.S.? Are they overseas? Combination of both?
Maybe. You know, I don't know. I mean, so much of what we do, I feel like, is trying not to have an opinion about these things so we can kind of report on them as they come in and let it sort of sway our opinion. But if I was going to actually take a guess, I would probably just go with what Charlie Hill said. And Charlie Hill is a guy who recovered many stolen paintings and worked for Scotland Yard as an art crime investigator. So an incredible background, amazing guy to sit down and chat with, also passed away in the last year. But he had said that there was two Irish brothers who were in the IRA, but this wasn't an IRA sanctioned job. And he sort of gave a location in a house in Dublin behind a wall. And I guess if I was going to say any specific area, I would say that there might be some paintings in that house.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. And I think they're probably all together. I think that's where I'm most convinced, is because you haven't seen one or two pop up here and there over the course of all of these years, all of these decades. And that just suggests to me that they're housed in one area altogether without the opportunity to sort of disperse them. But now Charlie Hill was amazing. And he, I think through his years of work, he's able to really nurture a relationship with criminals where they trust him and it's genuine. because he wants to do the right thing and they see that. And I think really, I think he was this close. He described that, that situation with the Irish brothers. And he said, you know, they were affiliated with the IRA, but this was sort of a vacation for them and it happened to happen and they took advantage of it. And then they realized like the gravity of it and the scope of it. And then he just wouldn't talk about it. We even kind of made a joke saying, well, you know, platform's always open for you, you know, when you get that phone call to come back on. And he kind of gave like a half chuckle. And then, unfortunately, he passed away.
He did give you, you know, isolated at least a possible location in County Monaghan. That it was a place that he thought, you know, was certainly of interest to the people that he was speaking to. Did Charlie pass on the baton to somebody else in the, you know, art detecting community to continue that work, do you think?
Not that we know of. I do think he left some breadcrumbs in that interview with us, though, intentionally. I believe one of the brothers is still missing, is what he said.
Yeah.
So I think that is a way that they could be identified.
And I would think just like how thorough he was, he must have had somebody who can pick up the information and try to continue on with that work. But I think his death was pretty sudden. I think it was a sudden heart attack and he passed. So I don't know if he like ever prepared for that because his death was just not expected. It wasn't like he was sick for a while and brought someone into his world and said, you know, here's what you got to do. I don't know if he had that opportunity.
Have you guys been in touch with his family in terms of, you know, did he have shoeboxes full of letters and information that somebody might want to pass on even to you guys to, you know, reveal on the show?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that we've thought about. And I think it's probably time, you know, we're not professional journalists by trade. So we try to figure out like the right timing and the right things to do. And I feel like now would probably be an appropriate time to reach out and see about any information that he's had. We've never had this situation happen before, so we're just trying to do the right thing. And I think that's a great idea. And I think the timing's probably right to do it in the next, you know, few weeks. I mean, if you're down to join us on this endeavor, we'll happily. Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, you're talking to two professional journalists and investigative reporters. So, you know, we would be happy to pick up Charlie's breadcrumbs and see where they lead, because I too was fascinated by some of the tidbits that he was dropping on your show, the missing brother and all of these things that I was waiting for him to expand upon. But, you know, investigative reporters or investigators like him, they always keep their information close to the vest and they just give you enough, you know, to you know, gauge your interest and keep it.
Oh my God, that would be incredible. As I was saying that, I realized when I said we're not trained journalists, I'm like, wait a sec. We're having a conversation with two of the best journalists in the city. That would be amazing.
Well, like you said, it's all about bringing the artwork back. You know, and people have that passion, you know, they look at those empty frames and they weep, you know, people that really love the art world and see such a loss of what these paintings kind of represent. True crime buffs like myself and Dave, you know, we do appreciate art, but maybe not to the level that some of the people that really are, you know, have suffered since 1990 without being able to see these paintings, you know, up close and personal.
You made a great point. I think whoever does find these one day is a hero, and everybody loves a hero. So it's definitely a worthy endeavor to continue to explore. Every lead should continue to be tracked down because as Casey and I have seen firsthand over and over and over with other cases, I mean, Whitey Bulger is Exhibit A. I mean, no one ever thought Whitey would be caught. They just didn't. No, much less did anyone ever think he'd be brought home alive. Everyone thought he would have been, you know, found dead somewhere or just never found. And the mystery would go on forever. So this is kind of in that vein. So, you know, it's funny, we in the Herald newsroom, my years at the Herald in the 90s and 2000s, it was a couple of stories we always talked about, you know, that were going to really impact the city and change things when it happened, be the biggest story I ever covered. It was obviously Whitey, and the Gardner Museum was another one that we talked about. So I think, you know, hats off to you guys for continuing this work. Yeah, we'll collaborate any way we can. If there's something we can help on, we'd love to, because certainly, you know, these things need to be found, and they're out there. Someone knows where they are, and And at some point, someone will crack.
You know, it's funny, that classic Simpsons episode where they bring you into Mr. Burns's lair and you see all the Gardner Museum paintings behind him. It's a story that I think is, you know, cross cultural boundaries as well. It's not just an art story. It's not just a true crime story. It's a cultural story that continues to fascinate. And Empty Frames is just a kick-ass podcast, guys. You guys really bring it each and every week. And each and every episode, you provide new perspectives and you allow us all to play the game of Clue, right? Everybody is putting the pieces on the board or around the museum itself, wondering, you know, who took it, what the, chain of custody and the evidence has been over the years, and where the hell those paintings and that Napoleonic finial are today. So it's exciting. You guys, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. Where can people listen to your podcast?
Wherever you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, everywhere. Thank you so much, Casey and Dave, for having us on.
All right, gents. Thank you.
Very cool. Thank you.
Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks,
Dave. Have a good one.
Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers is a joint production of Mudhouse Media and Fort Point Media. Produced and edited by Mike Joshua. For more from the Mudhouse Media Podcast Network, visit mudhousemedia.com. And for the latest on their podcasts and all of the writing and film projects of Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, visit fortpointmedia.com.